When the average lifespan of a church in the United States is 73 years, and when your church is 348 years old, you get to asking, how did we beat the odds? Why are we still here? And at least one of those answers is transitions. Transitions. Think of Christian faith across the centuries as a relay race. One generation takes up the baton, runs with it, does their level best to run with integrity, with joy, with courage, with Christly purpose. And finally, exhausted, old, weak, they relinquish the baton, handing it to the next generation, who in turn take it up and run for all that they are worth until they too are spent. If you've ever watched a relay race, you know it is the transitions, the passing of the baton from one to another, that is the trickiest moment. Bad things can happen. The runners can trip or swerve outside the lane or miss the handoff, even drop the baton. Over the course of 348 years, the members and the ministers of this church have managed some very tricky transitions. Passing the baton in times of war, during periods of epidemic, massive social upheavals, economic depression. The members and ministers have passed the baton of faith down through the centuries, from olden times to modernity, from Christendom to post-Christendom, from British aristocracy to American meritocracy, from white, male, and straight to rainbow. If a generation is 30 years, we are halfway into the 12th generation, you and I. The first generation commenced in an argument over the waters of baptism. Our forebears believed the church should be generous, not stingy, in administering the sacrament of God's grace. And our forebears tried to persuade their fellow congregants in Boston's first church of their position, but failed. Christian conscience forced them to part with First Church and start another. For their troubles, they were called the dissenting brethren. 28 men and their wives and Mary Norton, Madam Norton, the widow of the previous minister of First Church. She sided with the dissenters and knew that her departed husband had seen it their way too. So how do you start a church from scratch? You start with 28 people of Christian conviction and their spouses. If you are lucky, Mary Norton gives you a deed of land, smack in the middle of town. Then you call a terrific minister, who happens also to be a medical doctor of great repute. You build a sweet meeting house in the heart of the town. Transitions are tricky, and passing the baton of faith from a founding pastor to the second can be fraught. When our founding minister, Thomas Thatcher, grows ill and aged, the church turns to Samuel Willard as the next, and we choose well. Some years into Willard's ministry, there arrives the woeful decade. The New England Puritans are fighting everyone: Indians, the French, the king, and the king's royal governors. And then enter the so-called witch trials. Old Southers are among the accused. Three of our members serve on the special court as justices, and our minister calls it what it is, madness, and works to end it. One justice, an Old Souther, later apologizes publicly, which is a big deal, an act of high Christian conscience. His apology is memorialized in a mural in the State House today. Our forebears successfully passed the baton again, helping to usher in a new age of tolerance. The second generation dawned with the publication by one of our members of the first public stand against slavery on this soil, a strong, biblically argued case as to why slavery is anathema to God. The second generation oversees the baptism of Benjamin Franklin, and our minister becomes the acting president of Harvard, and we who were once dissenters have arrived. The third generation takes up the baton by building a new, larger, splendid meeting house to accommodate an ever-growing congregation. Because love and charity are Christian virtues, this generation institutes benevolence, organizes benevolence as a formal structural function of the church, establishing a fund for charitable and pious uses, the oldest in the colony, which is in our hands today. The third generation embraces a new theological movement of intense personal spiritual feeling, inviting its most famous open-air preacher, George Whitefield, to our meeting house. While many established churches are threatened by this movement and wary of it, not this church. Under the Spirit's warm and fervent sway, the church grows and memorably baptizes and welcomes more people of African descent, more enslaved people, than any other Boston church. The fourth generation is handed a hot baton, hot with revolution. The Stamp Act greatly exacerbates ill will that is already very much felt toward the crown. But while trouble is still brewing, our members are still baptizing. Phyllis Wheatley, an enslaved young woman who will write her way into history, joins this church. In 1773, our members and ministers agree to host the incendiary meetings that eventually spill out into Rose Wharf and leave Boston Harbor steeping in tea from China. We are punished a couple of years later. A fuming British army invades and garrisons in Boston, seize our meeting house, desecrate and damage it. The siege of Boston lasts but a year, but the damage is far more lasting. Our congregation is scattered, our members' homes and businesses plundered, our meeting house ruined, our parsonage torn up and consumed, our young minister takes ill and dies. It is nearly 10 years before the fourth generation rebuilds and returns to the meeting house. Remarkably, they call a minister to this period, and by 1785, they are singing up a storm. William Billings, a father of American psalmody, is in our meeting house, teaching, singing, and rehearsing choirs. The fifth generation commences in 1789. Under the leadership of Joshua Huntington, they are busy founding a slew of institutions, many of them extant today. The American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, City Mission Society, the American Education Society, the Old South Charity School, which had 103 students, the Fragment Society, the Singing School with 100 students. These are but a few. In the mid to late 1800s, a creeping theological liberalism insinuates itself into Harvard College and slithers into the pulpits of New England. Unitarianism. But our forebears toe the Christian line. Under the leadership of Joshua Huntington, we remain firmly Trinitarian, the only congregational church in Boston to do so. Reverend Huntington dies at the young age of 33, and the church is again looking for a minister, once again facing a tricky time of transition. The church settles on Benjamin Wisner. They like him well enough, but there are some matters that need to be resolved before the two can move forward together. First, will he, an extemporaneous preacher, submit, as they require, to the discipline of preaching from a manuscript? Second, will he agree to the installation of a pipe organ in the meeting house? Though not yet installed, the organ has been ordered and is en route. Finally, will he agree to wear a preaching gown? Benjamin Wisner assents to all three demands. Thereafter, the ladies of the church thoughtfully present him a preaching gown. The promised pipe organ arrives shortly thereafter, installed in 1822, built by Thomas Eliot of London. 13 is an unlucky number. Don't be 13. Here commences the incredibly sad story of a three-week ministry. From the slight and sickly Samuel Stearns, the church next turns to a hale and hearty George Blagden. A leader in many important organizations, Blagden and the church run with the baton of faith in the wrenching heat up to the Civil War. Blagden's sons will both serve proudly in the Union Army, while his daughter marries a Confederate general. The church and the times are too much for one minister, so the church calls a colleague pastor, the young, charismatic Jacob Manning. Serving side by side, Blagden sympathizes with the South, while Manning, a radical abolitionist, preaches a fiery gospel of freedom. Blagden retires and Manning wins the church over. In fact, he turns the meeting house into a recruiting station for the Union Army. No separation of church and state here. Manning asks leave of the church to go to war, not to fight, but to serve as a chaplain. Granted a paid leave, he accompanies the 43rd Massachusetts Volunteers to North Carolina. His chaplain's tent on the field of battle is a haven for the soldiers. Unfortunately, under cold and wet conditions, Manning takes ill. He returns to Boston, shaken and never quite the same again. Boston, too, has changed. And the question of the decade for this church, should we move or not? The surrounding buildings are all commercial now. The residences have moved further out. Besides, it's noisy and stinky in the heart of Boston. The church wrestles long and hard with this question when there happens the Great Fire of Boston in 1872. The flames lick up against the meeting house. It doesn't burn to the ground, but it is damaged. The question of whether to leave the historic meeting house and to abandon the land given to them by Mary Norton is suddenly urgent. For the church, the future calls. The new building is itself a statement. It's as if the building shouts, "We're not Puritans anymore." Bostonians, in fact, confer upon us a new name, the New Old South Church. And here in Copley Square, we take up the baton anew, carrying the ancient faith into yet another context altogether. George Gordon, born in Scotland, a great liberal pulpiteer of the 19th century, is called to be the 16th senior minister. He moves into the rectory, the Gordon House. Gordon serves during World War I, as Old South members all take their part one way or another in the cause. Some go to war. Some make the ultimate sacrifice. Russell Henry Stafford takes hold of the baton and carries it stoically through the Great Depression. It is this generation's lot to finally address the great Leaning Tower. Leaning for too long, it reaches a dangerous incline. It must be raised. It is no small thing getting it down, taking it apart safely, putting stone by putting stone. But it is a harder thing yet getting it back up and financing the rebuilding, putting all those stones back to rights. The baton in hand, the 10th generation runs the race of faith during World War II. Dr. Meek and his generation take up the baton of faith during the upheavals of the Civil Rights Movement, the 1960s sexual revolution, the Vietnam War. A young Martin Luther King worships here and takes notes on Dr. Meek's sermons. The church responds to the times by founding a radio broadcast ministry, reaching into the nearby campuses with strong, deep ministries with students. Meek is a founding leader in the formation of the United Church of Christ, arguing for and winning the addition into the Constitution of local church autonomy. And the sanctuary hosts 1,000 New England youth who praise God in their own way. In the course of the 11th generation, Dr. Meek passes the baton to James W. Crawford. Crawford, may I call you that? Crawford and his generation carry the baton of faith through Boston's painful saga of desegregation and busing, commitment to affordable housing, through the AIDS epidemic and gay rights. They offer the inclusive dimension of God's grace on the back of your bulletins. They restore the sanctuary, install the E.M. Skinner organ, join forces with Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, found cooperative metropolitan ministries and friendship works and others, author the New Century Hymnal, and address social and religious matters of language, gender, and justice. And today, what of today? We of the 12th generation are still baptizing, still marking ourselves and our children with the waters of God's amazing grace. taking our faith to the streets, carrying the baton, running the race in the times given to us, the first female senior minister, the first openly gay minister, the first minister arrested on purpose. Holding the baton, running the race through the matter of the crack, selling of the Bay Psalm book, beta copy, and achieving financial stability. Expansion of worship services and music programs, outreach and growth of the congregation, hosting Boston Pride, blessing marathon athletes, ministering in the wake of terror. We're still singing, still praising God. Running toward our 350th anniversary, we are being formed in small groups, Bible study, prayer, and theological studies. We carry the baton as we address interfaith work in the face of Islamophobia, and we do what we can in the face of the vexing conundrum of homelessness. We are committed to children's ministries and godly play, to working with the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization and through Grace Talks, coming to terms with the sin and the catastrophe of racism. We are hosting the world, giving testimony, giving witness in Copley Square to Boston and beyond of a generous God, a God who is more mercy than judgment. In a few minutes, our church moderator, Deb Washington, will ring in the 347th meeting of this church. And here is what I believe, that from heaven today, our forebears are cheering us on as we run our part in this relay race of faith. Mary Norton and Thomas Thatcher are cheering us on from heaven's gallery. Samuel Sewell and Phyllis Wheatley and Samuel Adams are there, rooting and cheering us on. And Harry Huff is there. Harry and Dave Chandler and Carmen Cunningham and Peter Meek, cheering us on. The baton of faith is in our hands. Run well, Old South Church. Run with God's wind.
You're here.